Gentleman yields back, Mr. Liu.
Thank you, Chairman Nadler. Let's just cut through all the Republican arguments today and make things very simple. No one else in America could do what Donald Trump did and get away with it. No American elected official can call up a foreign government official and ask for an investigation of a political opponent. No one sitting on this Judiciary Committee can call up a foreign government official and ask for help in a re-election campaign. If we did that and got caught, we would likely be indicted. Now let's focus on the president's abuse of power in this case, because it's actually worse than the examples I just gave. And I note that I first swore an oath to the Constitution when I joined the United States Air Force on active duty. And the three core values I learned were integrity first, service before self, excellence, and all we do. I'd like to focus on the first two, integrity first and service before self, because it's ingrained in all military members that we cannot mix official duties with personal private gain. So, Mr. Goldman, in this case, the $391 million at issue, that wasn't Donald Trump's money. That was U.S. taxpayer funds. Is that right?
Yes.
And certainly the president should not use our taxpayer money for his own personal benefit, and especially not to leverage it for his own re-election campaign. Isn't that right?
That's correct.
The president's abuse of power is even worse in this case than just using official duties for private gain. It's also just flat-out illegal. You cannot solicit foreign assistance for a re-election campaign. That is a violation of Federal Election Campaign Act. Multiple people have gone to prison for violating various sections of that act. A reasonable person could also conclude that the president violated the Impoundment Control Act of 1974, which Congress passed as a response to President Nixon's abuse of power. So I'd like to explore that a little further with you, Mr. Goldman. In this case, Congress, with bipartisan support, had appropriated taxpayer funds for the specific purpose of aiding Ukraine in its war against Russia. Is that right?
Yes.
And not only had that money been appropriated, the money had actually been released to the Department of Defense. Is that right?
They were about to release it, yes.
Okay. And then, suddenly, without explanation, the president demanded that those taxpayer funds be withheld from an ally who desperately needed the aid. Mr. Goldman, did the president notify Congress about his decision to withhold the aid?
No, he did not.
So the Impoundment Control Act was designed to prevent the president from secretly taking congressionally appropriated funds and doing whatever he wants with them. So is it true that in your intelligence report, you found the following in your findings of fact? President Trump ordered the suspension of $391 million in vital military assistance urgently needed by Ukraine, and the president did so despite his obligations under the Impoundment Control Act. Did you find that?
Yes.
All right. So not only did the president abuse his powers for personal gain, and not only was it illegal, his actions also harmed U.S. national security. So it's a fundamental tenet of U.S. national security to push back against Russian aggression. Ukraine's at the tip of the spear, pushing back against Russian aggression. Is it true, Mr. Goldman, that harming the Ukrainian military also harms U.S. national security?
That's what pretty much every witness said.
Last week, Professor Carlin confirmed that it is an impeachable offense to sacrifice a national interest for his own private ends. A slide shows what she said. Mr. Goldman, based on the evidence that you found in your report, is it fair to conclude that the president's actions both leveraged taxpayer funds for his own private gain and sacrificed a national interest for his own private ends?
That is what we found.
I was also perfectly struck by Mr. Holmes' testimony, because it makes it clear that the president did not care about our foreign policy or U.S. national security. He only cared about investigating his political opponent. Here's what Mr. Holmes said.
Ambassador Sondland stated that the president only cares about big stuff. I noted there was big stuff going on in Ukraine, like a war with Russia. And Ambassador Sondland replied that he meant big stuff that benefits the president, like the Biden investigation that Mr. Giuliani was pushing.
Look, here's the thing. If any military member used official acts for personal gain, that member would no longer be part of the military. And in fact, last year, a Navy commander was convicted for taking things of value in exchange for official acts. The U.S. attorney who prosecuted the case said that the commander, quote, put his own selfish interests ahead of the Navy and of our nation, unquote. We should not hold the commander-in-chief to a lower standard than regular military members. We should not hold the president to a different standard than any other elected official. no one is above the law. I yield back.
Gentleman yields.
Gentleman yields back. Mr. McClintock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, in every election, one side wins and the other loses. Democracy only works because the losing side always respects the will of the voters. The moment that social compact breaks down, democracy collapses into chaos. Now, that's only happened twice in our nation's history. It happened in 1860 when the Democrats refused to accept the legitimate election of Abraham Lincoln. And it happened again in 2016 when the Democrats refused to accept the legitimate election of Donald Trump. The issues before us today do indeed strike at the heart of our democracy. The first calls for impeachment began just days after the 2016 election, and ever since, the Democrats have been searching for a pretext. When the Mueller investigation found no evidence to support the monstrous lie that the president acted in collusion with Russia, the Democrats realized they were running out of time, and suddenly the Ukrainian phone call replaced collusion, Stormy Daniels, tax returns, emoluments, and even tweets as the reason to nullify the election just a year before the next one is to be held. Impeachment is one of the most serious powers with which Congress is entrusted. It requires an overwhelming case of high crime supported by clear evidence that a vast majority of the nation deems compelling. Our Constitution vests the executive authority, including the enforcement of our laws, with the president, and it gives him sole authority to conduct our foreign affairs. Clearly, this includes requesting a foreign government to cooperate in resolving potentially corrupt and illegal interactions between that government's officials and ours. Now, the sum total of the Democrats' case comes down to this. Not one of their hand-picked witnesses provided any first-hand knowledge of the president ordering a quid pro quo, and two witnesses, Sonderland by testimony and Senator Johnson by letter, provided first-hand testimony that the president specifically ordered no quid pro quo. No testimony was provided that the Ukrainian government believed that there was any quid pro quo, but there are ample public statements that its officials did not believe there was such a linkage. In fact, the testimony of their witnesses crumbled under questioning, and we were left with career bureaucrats who admitted that the only evidence they offered was presumption, speculation, and what they'd read in the New York Times. It's upon this flimsy evidence that the Democrats justify nullifying the 2016 presidential election. And it's so flimsy, the Democrats have had to turn our Bill of Rights on its head in order to make it. They've argued that hearsay evidence, better known as gossip, is better than direct testimony. They've argued that the burden of proof rests with the accused to prove his innocence, while at the same time denying the defense witnesses permission to testify. They've argued that the right to confront your accuser is an invasion of the accuser's privacy. They've argued that appealing to the courts to defend your constitutional rights, as the president has done, is ipso facto obstruction of justice and evidence of guilt. They've asserted the power to determine what witnesses the defense is allowed to call. And they've argued that a crime is not necessary to impeach, only impure motives in performing otherwise lawful acts, motives, of course, to be divined entirely by the accusers. These are the legal doctrines of despots, but they're the only ones that can accommodate the case before us today. This is a stunning abuse of power and a shameless travesty of justice that will stain the reputations of those responsible for generations to come. And God help our country if they should ever be given the power to replace our Bill of Rights with the doctrines that they have imposed in this process. The Democrats are fond of saying no one's above the law, but they have one unspoken caveat, except for themselves. Now, the Speaker's already short-circuited what should be a solemn, painstaking, thorough, and above all, fair process by ordering her foot soldiers on this committee to draw up articles of impeachment without this committee hearing from a single fact witness. Despite the fact that Mr. Schiff doesn't dare to appear before this committee to defend his work, we're supposed to accept his report at face value and obediently follow the Speaker's orders. As the Red Queen declared, sentence first, verdict afterwards. We can only pray the Senate still adheres to the judicial principles of our founders. And if they do, Perhaps then we can begin repairing the damage that this travesty has done to our democracy, our institutions, our principles of justice, our Constitution, and our country.
Gentleman yields back.
Gentleman yields back, Mr. Raskin.
Thank you. Why is impeachment in the Constitution? Well, the framers feared a president might corrupt our elections by dragging foreign powers into our politics in order to promote the personal political ambitions of the president above the rule of law and above the national security. The framers set against a potential tyrant's boundless thirst for power the people's representatives here in Congress and the people's own democratic ambitions, our self-respect, our love of freedom and the rule of law, our fierce constitutional patriotism. Now, it looked like President Trump might get away with his Ukraine shakedown. After all, most Americans didn't know anything about it, and the few who learned of it would be too afraid, too intimidated to cross the most powerful man on earth. President Trump could rest easy. But if Donald Trump misjudged the American character, the framers of our Constitution did not. I count 17 honorable public servants who came forward to testify over the intimidation and disparagement of the president. Is that right, Mr. Goldman?
Yes, there were 17.
And I count a dozen career State Department and national security officials who served Republican and Democratic presidents alike over decades who came to testify. In fact, four of President Trump's own National Security Council staffers, Hill, Vindman, Morrison, and McGuire, came forward to report Trump's scheme to NSC lawyers. As soon as they learned of it, didn't they, Mr. Goldman?
Morrison and Vindman went to the lawyers as soon as they learned of it, yes.
They went to the lawyers, and that moved me a lot because my father was a staffer on the National Security Council under President Kennedy. And he said the most important thing you can bring to work with you every day is your conscience. And he devoted his career to the idea that people must speak truth to power when power becomes a clear and present danger to democracy and to the people. So I want to talk about two of the many honorable government witnesses who went under oath and stood up for the truth. Mr. Goldman, who is Dr. Fiona Hill?
Dr. Fiona Hill was the senior director for the Europe and Russia Directorate at the National Security Council until July of this year.
And she was President Trump's senior advisor on Russia?
Correct.
Her family had fled both Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia?
I think her family actually came from England. It was Marie Ivanovich who had...
That was Ambassador Ivanovich.
Yes.
Dr. Hill voiced her concerns to the NSC's lawyers on July 10 and July 11th, long before anyone on this committee knew about it. Why did she go to report what she had learned? What motivated her?
She was concerned that Ambassador Sondland and Mick Mulvaney were entering into essentially a transaction whereby the Ukrainians would open up these investigations for President Trump's political interests in return for getting the White House meeting that President Trump had offered.
And I want to talk about Deputy Assistant Secretary George Kent, who served as a career Foreign Service officer for more than 27 years under five different presidents, Democrats and Republicans alike. And he wrote or updated notes to file on four different occasions to record his grave contemporaneous concerns about the president's conduct. Mr. Goldman, what were the events that led Mr. Kent to draft these notes to his file?
There were several. There was a conversation at the end of June where several American officials had indicated to President Zelensky that he needed to go forward with these investigations. There was one on August 16th, I recall, that he talked about. But you bring up a very important point, which is all of these State Department witnesses in particular, and frankly almost all of the witnesses other than Ambassador Sondland, took unbelievable meticulous notes. I would have dreamed for a witness like that as a prosecutor. And it makes for a very clear and compelling record and clear and compelling evidence that's based on contemporaneous notes.
So do we have Mr. Kent's notes in this process?
We have no State Department records, including these memos to file, the notes, Ambassador Taylor's first-person cable, and emails. There are so many documents that the few that we have gotten have been so helpful to the investigation.
Well, why do we not have them?
The State Department refused to provide them, notwithstanding our subpoena, under the president's direction.
You know, in authoritarian societies like Putin's Russia or the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, people are terrified to speak out about the crimes of their political leaders. But in the United States, a lot of people are not afraid, even though President Trump has tried to intimidate or silence them. And he is trying to make our country more like Russia, and we can be thankful that you found a lot of heroes who stood up for the truth in our Constitution. I yield back.
Gentleman yields back. Ms. Lesko.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My first two questions are for the American people. America, are you sick and tired yet of this impeachment sham? And America, would you like Congress to get back to work and actually get something done? As I sure would. Mr. Castor, the rest of the questions are for you, and I would like yes or no answers if possible. Mr. Castor, my first question is important. Did any of the Democrats' fact witnesses establish that the president had committed bribery, extortion, or a high crime or misdemeanor?
Good heavens, no.
Mr. Castor, the deputy assistant to the president of the national security, Mr. Morrison, listened in on the phone call. He testified that he was not concerned that anything discussed on the phone call was illegal or improper. Is that correct?
Yeah, he was worried about leaks.
Several Democrat witnesses testified that it is fairly common for foreign aid to be paused for various reasons, including concerns that the country is corrupt and taxpayer dollars may be misspent. Ambassador Volker testified that this hold on security assistance to Ukraine was not significant. Is that correct?
Yes, a number of witnesses can also said the same thing.
Former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Ivanovich, testified that in Ukraine, and I quote, corruption is not just prevalent, but frankly is the system. Is that correct?
Yes, all the witnesses confirmed the environment is very corrupt.
Mr. Castor, Ukraine energy company Burisma Holdings had a reputation in Ukraine as a corrupt company. Is that correct?
Big time.
According to New York Times, Hunter Biden was part of a broad effort by Burisma to bring in well-connected Democrats during a period when the company was facing investigations. Is that correct?
Yeah, the New Yorker also had a pretty extensive report on that as well.
Obama's Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, George Kent, testified that he raised concerns directly to Vice President Biden's office about Hunter Biden's services on Burisma's board. Is that correct, yes or no?
Yes.
Mr. Castor, in the July 25th call, President Trump referenced Joe Biden bragging about how he stopped the prosecution. We all saw that video earlier today, where Joe Biden bragged about how he told Ukraine, if the prosecutor is not fired, you're not getting the money. Mr. Castor, is this the same prosecutor that looked into Burisma?
It is.
In a similar scheme, Obama Assistant Attorney General said, and I quote, awarding prestigious employment opportunities to unqualified individuals in order to influence government officials is corruption, plain and simple. Mr. Castor, here is another key question. Given that, one, Burisma had a reputation of being a corrupt company, two, Obama's own State Department was concerned about Hunter Biden serving on Burisma's board at the same time that Vice President Biden was acting as the point person to Ukraine. And three, Obama's Assistant Attorney General said in a similar scheme that there was corruption, plain and simple. Do you think then it is understandable, reasonable and acceptable for President Trump to ask the Ukrainian president to look into the Hunter Biden Burisma potential corruption scheme?
Yes.
Mr. Castor, There are four undisputable facts that will never change that prove there is no impeachable offense. There was no quid pro quo on the July 25th call. Ukraine leadership did not know the aid was held up at the time of the July 25th telephone call. Ukraine received the White House meeting, phone call, and aid, even though four, Ukraine didn't initiate any investigations. Do you agree?
Ukraine received a meeting with Vice President Pence in Warsaw and a meeting not at the White House but at the in New York at the United Nations.
Mr. Castor, did Mr. Turley testify in the past hearing that this impeachment inquiry has not passed Chairman Nadler's three-prong test?
He did.
Thank you. Now I yield back.
Thank you. The gentlewoman from Washington is recognized.
Thank you. Mr. Goldman, let's focus on the Republican claim that President Trump withheld military aid to Ukraine because he was supposedly concerned about corruption rather than the fact that he abused his office for personal gain. And let me be clear, we actually do not have to read the president's mind on this. As your report notes on page 10, and as we will see on television, he told us himself exactly what his intent was.
What is that?
Well, I would think that if they were honest about it, they'd start a major investigation into the Biden. It's a very simple answer.
So the first and best witness about the president's corrupt intent was Donald Trump. There is also plenty of corroborating evidence, so let's just review some of the basic facts that we've already established. First, President Trump does not even mention the word corruption during either of his calls with President Zelensky, and he disregards all of the talking points that were prepared for him on corruption by the National Security Council. Second, investigations of the Bidens and a debunked conspiracy theory about the 2016 election were not supported by official U.S. policy. And third, Congress authorized military aid to Ukraine. Ukraine passed all the checks that the United States established to ensure that it was taking appropriate actions to fight corruption. And there was unanimous consensus among the State Department, Department of Defense, and National Security Council that the president should release the military aid that Ukraine critically needed to fight Russian aggression. So, Mr. Goldman, between the time that President Trump put a hold on military aid to Ukraine and then released the aid, the president never conducted an actual review or corruption assessment on Ukraine, did he?
That is correct. There was no witness testified that there was any review or any investigation of any sort related to the Ukraine aid.
And isn't it also true that the Defense Department actually determined not to conduct a review on Ukraine after the president froze the military aid because Ukraine had already met all of the corruption benchmarks in May of 2019?
Yes, and everyone involved in Ukraine policy believed that they were on the right path, and President Zelensky in particular.
And in addition to Ukraine having satisfied all the relevant corruption assessments prior to U.S. military aid being withheld, there is significant witness testimony that both the State Department and the Ukrainian embassy actually advised that a White House meeting with President Zelensky would help further an anti-corruption agenda, correct?
Both the anti-corruption agenda and the fighting the aggression from Russia.
And in fact, President Trump's budget actually cut funding for fighting corruption in Ukraine. Now, Mr. Castor argues that President Trump withheld military aid to Ukraine because he was skeptical of foreign assistance in general. But in both 2017 and 2018, didn't President Trump release military aid for Ukraine without any complaints about corruption?
That's correct.
So, Mr. Goldman, the president was perfectly fine giving military aid to Ukraine in 2017 and 2018, but somehow not in 2019. So what changed?
Joe Biden started running for president.
Vice President Biden started running. So the sequence.
And I would add the Mueller report came out, which did not, even though it did not charge the president, it implicated the president and his campaign in welcoming the assistance from Russia and utilizing it.
And the sequence of events and all the corroborating evidence makes it crystal clear that President Trump didn't care about corruption at all. In fact, as he told us himself on national television, he simply cared about his own politically motivated investigations into his political rival. And you saw the clip where Ambassador Sondland picked up the phone, called President Trump, and then Mr. Holmes asked him what the president thought about Ukraine, and quickly, what was Mr. Sondland's answer?
Mr. Sondland said the president does not give a bleep about Ukraine. He only cares about the big stuff, meaning the Biden investigation that Mr. Giuliani was pushing. And by the way, just to add, that is a direct evidence conversation between President Trump and Ambassador Sondland on that day. And there are many that we have not talked about on the minority.
So we know what President Trump was interested in based on his words, his actions, and witness testimony. The President of the United States wanted Ukraine to announce an investigation into a political rival for his own personal political benefit to interfere in our election, and he was willing to use U.S. military aid, which is taxpayer dollars, and an essential White House meeting as his leverage. That is unacceptable and a grave abuse of power. I yield back.
The gentleman from Pennsylvania is recognized for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. You know, in the Navy, we had a saying, bluff, which is bottom line up front. Let me give everybody the bottom line. We're here because Democrats are terrified that President Trump is going to win re-election. That's really what this all comes down to. Let me get into the specifics. We're here dealing with impeachment because Democrats don't want to talk about the red-hot Trump economy. They don't want to talk about the fact that we have the lowest unemployment rates in 50 years. We're dealing with impeachment because Democrats don't want to talk about how the president has worked to protect American companies from Chinese aggression, how he's renegotiated trade deals to benefit American workers, how he's eliminated burdensome regulations that hurt the economy and that help job creators. Congressional Democrats don't want to be reminded that the American people, that the Democrat agenda includes such laughable ideas like banning airplanes, giving illegal immigrants taxpayer-funded health care, and taking private health insurance away from the American people. That's really why we're here. This whole process is just a distraction. It's an attempt to hide the far left radical agenda. So let's talk about the facts. Schiff's report claims the administration froze military aid for Ukraine without explanation. Yet the facts are that President Trump gave more military aid to Ukraine than President Obama. President Obama gave Ukraine well wishes and blankets. President Trump gave the Ukrainians Javelin missiles. That's the difference, and those are the facts. Let's go over some more facts. House Democrats want to claim it's a conspiracy that Ukrainian officials attempted to interfere with the 2016 election. Yet Ukrainian attempts to interfere with the 2016 election are well documented by Politico, by Financial Times, and The Hill. There was an attempt to influence our elections, and that's troubling, and that's why President Trump brought it to the attention of President Zelensky. Again, those are the facts. But at the end of the day, those facts don't seem to matter to my Democrat colleagues. House Democrats don't care that President Zelensky has repeatedly said there was no pressure. It's not important that the call transcript was the best evidence we have. It is the best evidence we have. It's the actual primary document. And that transcript shows there was no quid pro quo, no bribery. I got to remember we're calling it bribery after an old Latin phrase didn't pull well or test well in a Democrat focus group. My Democrat colleagues seem to really care about focus groups and polling. Unfortunately, again, they don't care about the facts. Because the fact is the Democrats were calling for impeachment before this investigation even began. Representative Tlaib said in January, I don't even think we were sworn in yet. She said in January, impeach the mother. Representative Green said in May, and I quote, I'm concerned that if we don't impeach this president, he will get reelected. These proceedings, this entire process, is nothing more than a political hit job. Well, unlike my Democrat colleagues, I actually do care about the facts, which is why I'm troubled that our committee did not hear from a single fact witness this entire time. We should be here hearing from Hunter Biden. We should be hearing from Schiff's staff. We know that Schiff's staff coordinated with a whistleblower. And again, we need to hear from the whistleblower. Last week, I offered a motion to subpoena the whistleblower to testify in executive session, meaning that he or she could testify behind closed doors. My Democrat colleagues voted my motion down in a partisan fashion. Mr. Castor, can you walk us through the inaccuracies in the whistleblower's complaint?
Well, the first thing about the complaint that troubles us is that it's clearly from an outsider who received information secondhand. The information presented in the complaint is clearly distorted. And it's from a person who is, it seems to be making a case, like an advocate, about what happened on the call. The whistleblower references a number of individuals inside the White House and at the State Department that he or she has spoken to form the basis of the complaint. We have not been able to piece together all those people, and talking to all those people is important. And there's a lot of, I'm running out of time here, but there's, you know, there's a reference to Lutsenko in the whistleblower complaint where witnesses have told us it's likely Shokin. Vindman and Morrison's testimony about why they went to talk to the lawyers, very different reasons. Mr. Breckbuehl.
The gentleman's time is expired.
I don't believe he was on the call. But...
I recognize the gentlewoman from Florida for 5 minutes.
Mr. Goldman, as a member of the Intelligence Committee, I saw significant firsthand evidence that President Trump conditioned our military aid on Ukraine announcing investigations into the 2016 election and the Bidens, and betrayed our national security interests in the process. For example, Ambassador Sondland told us that once the Ukrainians found out about the aid being withheld, it was made, and I quote, abundantly clear to them that if they wanted the aid, and I quote, they were going to have to make these statements. Mr. Goldman, beginning on and around the 25th of July call through September, would you agree that, consistent with the testimony we just reviewed, Ukraine was made aware that to receive our military aid and the White House visit, that they were going to have to make a statement announcing the investigations?
Not only were they made aware, but they were made aware either by President Trump's proxy, Rudy Giuliani, or from President Trump himself through Ambassador Sondland, who spoke to President Zelensky and Andrei Yermak on September 7th and told them what President Trump had confirmed to him, that the aid was conditioned on the investigations.
And by the end of August, President Zelensky did in fact commit to making that statement on CNN. Is that correct?
That's right. Finally, President Zelensky relented after months of trying to not get involved in what he called the domestic U.S. political process, and ultimately recognizing that he had no choice to break the stalemate, as Ambassador Sondland told them, that he ultimately agreed to go on television before the before President Trump got caught and released the aid.
I'd like to direct your attention to the screen in front of you, which displays, again, a Washington Post article from September 5th. The headline says, Trump tries to force Ukraine to meddle in the 2020 elections, and the article reports that President Trump is, and I quote, attempting to force Zelensky to intervene in the 2020 U.S. presidential election by launching an investigation of the leading Democratic candidate, Joe Biden. Mr. Trump is not just soliciting Ukraine's help with his presidential campaign, he is using United States military aid the country desperately needs in an attempt to extort it. So am I correct, Mr. Goldman, that by September 25th, allegations that President Trump was using military aid to pressure Ukraine to announce investigation was being widely reported?
I'm sorry, by what date?
September 5th.
Yes. Well, widely reported. Certainly the aid being withheld was widely reported.
And by September 9th, our investigative committees formally announced a congressional investigation into the president of these issues, into the president about these issues. And Mr. Goldman, what day did President Trump release the military aid?
2 days after the investigations were announced and 2 days after the IG, the Inspector General, told the Intelligence Committee that there was a complaint that was being withheld.
So then am I correct that as the timeline on the screen in front of you shows, it wasn't until after the whistleblower complaint, after the Washington Post report, and after Congress launched the investigations that President Trump finally released the aid?
That's right. And I would just add one thing briefly to the congressman's point, that it is true that President Trump has given more military assistance than President Obama. And so one would wonder, if he does support military assistance so much, why then is he holding it up for more than 2 months?
And matter of fact, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman testified that people at the NSC, in fact, discussed that Congress's investigation, quote, might have the effect of releasing the hold on Ukraine's military aid because it would be potentially politically challenging to justify the aid. Is that correct, Mr. Goldman?
That was the testimony, yes.
In other words, the aid was released after the president got caught. And what makes me angry is that this president, President Trump, thinks he can get away with it. But he got caught, and he tried to cover it up. But we won't let him do that. And we thank God, Mr. Goldman, for the true, courageous public servants who came forward in spite of intimidation and obstruction from the White House. You see, everybody counts. But everybody is accountable, up to and including the President of the United States. Thank you, and I yield back.
Thank you. The chair. Okay. The chair recognizes the gentleman from Texas, Mr. Correa. I'm sorry, California.
A lot of people are moving from Texas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Goldman. My colleagues keep talking about the fact that the president apparently said, and I quote, no quid pro quo on September 7th in a call with Ambassador Sondland. Mr. Goldman, did you receive testimony about this September 7th call?
Yes, we received testimony from three witnesses about it, and it gets a little complicated, but that was a consistent refrain through all of the witnesses, is that the president did say no quid pro quo.
Well, let's try to clarify it a little bit. Ambassador Sondland described that call to Mr. Morrison that same day, correct?
That's right.
And Mr. Morrison then reported it to Ambassador Taylor, correct?
That's correct, yes.
And both Mr. Morrison and Ambassador Taylor took notes of those discussions.
They did.
Were those notes produced to the committee?
They were not produced to us, but the witnesses said that they relied on their notes to provide their testimony.
That set of notes was blocked consistent with the president's direction?
Correct.
And in his recitation to Mr. Morrison, Ambassador Sondland said that President Trump himself brought up the words quid pro quo.
That's right. Ambassador Sondland also said that too, yes.
And Mr. Goldman, what did the committee make of this fact?
Well, it was quite odd that the president would volunteer in response to nothing about a quid pro quo that there was no quid pro quo.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say what's even more important is that what he said immediately after that, which is effectively conduct that amounts to a quid pro quo. He said there's no quid pro quo, but you have to go to the microphone and make this announcement.
Well, let's talk about that. What did the committee make of the fact that, according to Ambassador Taylor and Mr. Morrison, right after President Trump said no quid pro quo, President Trump then told Ambassador Sondland that Ukrainian President Zelensky would have to go to the microphone and announce the investigations of Biden and the 2016 election interference, and that President Zelensky should want to do that himself?
That's right. We had a number of different accounts of this, and I think this is...
They're up on the boards here.
Right, I see that. Yes, Ambassador Taylor said that. Mr. Morrison said something similar. Their understandings of that conversation is that there was a clear directive that there was a quid pro quo, factually, from the conduct, from the actions. And we've talked a lot today about the words, and that Zelensky said no pressure, and Trump said no pressure, and no quid pro quo. But as an investigator, as a prosecutor, you need to look at the actions to understand what those words mean. And that's why this call in particular is so important.
So let's go further. As we've discussed, multiple individuals reacted with concern to President Trump's call with Ambassador Sondland. Do you recall Mr. Morrison's reaction?
Mr. Morrison said that he was shocked, I think, and that he... Sinking feeling, correct, and that he went and then talked to the lawyers at the direction of Ambassador Bolton.
Correct. And Mr. Goldman, Ambassador Taylor also testified that he concluded that the military aid was conditioned on Zelensky announcing the investigations, and he testified that this was illogical, crazy, and wrong. Is that right?
That was what Ambassador Taylor testified to, yes.
Now, my colleagues have also pointed out that on September 9th, text message from Sondland reflecting that President has been crystal clear that there is no quid pro quo. Mr. Goldman, am I correct that Ambassador Sondland has now testified that prior to sending his text, he himself came to believe that the aid was conditioned on the announcement of investigations?
Yes, Ambassador Sondland's subsequent public testimony revealed at least two things that were precisely false, that were not true in that text message, including that there was no quid pro quo of any kind when he testified, and we saw the video earlier, that there absolutely, assuredly was as it related to the White House meeting.
And this September 7th call and the September 9th text occurred after the press reports, that is, after the press reports that President Trump was conditioning military aid on investigations of his political rival. Is
yes.
that correct?
Yes, and it also, this text occurred after Ambassador Sondland relayed President Trump's message to President Zelensky.
Mr. Goldman, did the investigative committee receive any other evidence relevant to the credibility of the president's assertion that there was no quid pro quo?
We received a lot of evidence, and all of the evidence points to the fact that there was a quid pro quo.
Thank you. I yield.
Mr. Chairman, I have a unanimous consent request.
Can you please hold it until I do my questions? Thank you.
It'll be very brief. It's just unanimous consent.
I recognize myself for 5 minutes. Mr. Goldman, you talked about actions speaking louder than words. So I want to focus on why it was an abuse of power for President Trump to use the American government to pressure the Ukraine president to benefit his reelection campaign. Let's look at what the president said in his July 25th call to the president of Ukraine. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman listened to the president's call and testified that when President Trump asked Ukraine for a favor, it wasn't a friendly request, it was really a demand. I'm going to direct your attention to this slide about Lieutenant Colonel Vindman's testimony. Why did he say the president's favor was a demand?
He said because the power disparity between the United States as the greatest power in the world and Ukraine, which is so dependent on the United States, not just for the military assistance, but for all of its support, made such a request effectively a demand because President Zelensky could not, in reality, say no.
Am I correct that this vast power disparity exists in part because Ukraine has been at war with Russia since Russia invaded 5 years ago, and over 13,000 of the Ukraine people have died? Is that correct?
Yes, and not only does the U.S. provide 10% of their military budget, but the United States is a critical ally in rallying other countries to support Ukraine. Europe actually gives the European Union gives, I think, four times as much money as the United States overall to Ukraine.
So President Trump knew that the Ukrainian president's back was against the wall and President Zelensky needed U.S. validation and support. Is that right?
Yes.
Now, according to the U.S. ambassador to the Ukraine, and we have Ambassador Taylor's testimony up there, it wasn't until after Ambassador Sondland told the Ukrainians that there would be a, quote, stalemate, end quote, on the aid that Zelensky agreed to announce the investigations that President Trump was demanding, correct?
That's right, yes.
Okay. And furthermore, the committee heard testimony that the Ukrainians felt they had, quote, no choice but to comply with President Trump's demands, correct?
That's right, yes, even after the aid was released.
Okay. In fact, when asked in front of President Trump in September whether he felt pressured. President Zelensky said, quote, I'm sorry, but I don't want to be involved to democratic open elections, elections of the USA, end quote. Is that right?
That sounds right if you're reading the quote, yes.
Okay. Now, the president and some of his defenders here have tried to excuse his misconduct by pointing to statements from the Ukraine president that he was not under pressure to give in to President Trump's demand. Did your investigative committees consider those statements by President Zelensky?
We did, and we found that the statements of what is effectively an extortion victim are not particularly relevant to the actual truth of the matter, because President Zelensky cannot, in reality, for the same reasons that he interpreted the request to be a demand, he can't go out and say that he did feel pressure, because that would potentially upset President Trump, and they're so dependent on the relationship with President Trump and the United States.
What one could almost say it's similar to a hostage testifying under duress.
It is certainly a duress would be a good word.
So when the president made these statements, and up to and including today, his country was still under attack by Russia, still hadn't gotten a meeting at the White House, and still needed aid from the United States, correct?
That's right. And David Holmes testified very, I think, persuasively about the importance of the White House meeting and of the relationship to Ukraine even after the aid was lifted, including pointing to today, when President Putin and President Zelensky met to discuss the war in the East.
So the evidence is clear that President Trump knew he had the power to force Ukraine's hand and took advantage of that desperation and abused the powers of his office by using our taxpayer dollars, basically, to get what he wanted, right?
Yes, and what's really important here, and I think it has to be clarified, is that the evidence showed that the president directly said to Ambassador Sondland that there was a quid pro quo with the security assistance. And there's been some debate and some discussion about that, but that is one thing that the evidence shows based on the Morrison testimony, the Taylor testimony, the Sondland testimony, and the texts. So that's very important to understand, that whatever we want to say about hearsay or whatever, that is direct evidence.
And that is precisely the kind of betrayal that our founders sought to prevent. I yield back to myself, and I'll recognize the gentleman from Virginia, Mr. Klein.
Madam Chair, you indicated to me that you would allow me to make my uniform consent after you had asked your question. So I'd ask for uniform consent, or excuse me, unanimous consent to introduce two letters.
The gentleman will suspend. Okay. The gentleman, who is seeking unanimous consent?
Yeah.
For what are you seeking unanimous consent?
Mr. Chairman, I have two letters addressed to you, one December 4, 2019, and one December 5, 2019.
Yeah, without objection.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
The gentleman from Virginia, Mr. Klein.
Mr. Chairman, I have a brief parliamentary inquiry regarding scheduling.
The gentleman from Virginia is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Last week, I expressed concern regarding the deeply flawed and partisan process the Democrat majority has been undertaking during this impeachment inquiry. Mr. Chairman, I'm particularly reminded of your quote, "There must never be a narrowly voted impeachment or an impeachment substantially supported by one of our major political parties and largely opposed by the other. Such an impeachment would lack legitimacy, would produce divisiveness and bitterness in our politics for years to come, and will call into question the very legitimacy of our political institutions." You made that statement back in 1998. Now, I'm glad we're moving on to presenting the quote-unquote evidence gathered in this report. Not to hear from direct fact witnesses, but a 300-page report that's built largely on hearsay, opinion, and speculation. And I'm especially outraged that the purported author of it, Chairman Schiff, is not here to answer our questions today. Now that we have the report and can discuss the facts within, or the lack thereof, there are four facts that will never change. Both President Trump and President Zelensky say there was no pressure. Second, the call transcript shows no conditionality between aid and an investigation. Three, Ukrainians were not aware that aid was withheld when the president spoke. And fourth, Ukraine didn't open an investigation but still received the aid and a meeting with President Trump. I want to move on to the idea of hearsay and the fact that this report contains so much of it and relies on so much of it. Mr. Caster, did the Democrats impeachment report rely on hearsay to support their assertions?
Yes, it did.
How many times were you able to find assertions based on hearsay?
We went through and counted over 50 instances of key facts.
Can you give us some of the examples of the hearsay being relied on by the majority to make their case?
You know, a lot of the information, for example, that Ambassador Taylor was communicating, he very diligently recorded notes about what some of the various officials told him, but it was about, you know, it was one and two steps removed from the actual fact. And that's the problem with hearsay, is that it's a whisper down the lane situation. And if some of the people that are doing the whispering have are predisposed to not like President Trump, then what they're whispering down the lane becomes even more distorted.
Did you also find instances where the Democrats' report used witnesses' speculations and presumptions?
And the biggest one, of course, and this has sort of become the big daddy of the hearing, is Sondland presuming that the aide was tied to the investigations? Because as he engaged in a back and forth with Mr. Turner, nobody on the planet told him that was the case.
Mr. Castor, I want to move on to foreign policy and the idea that somehow the president was abusing foreign policy. Repeatedly, witnesses came before the Intelligence Committee and talked about how the president was operating outside the bounds of the process for abusing norms. The president sets foreign policy, correct?
Absolutely.
And from where does he derive that power?
The Constitution.
Article 2, Section 2, in fact.
People, yeah.
Can you give us examples of these members of the foreign policy establishment who took issue with the president's foreign policy direction and choices?
Well, for example, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman testified that when he was listening to the call, he had prepared talking points and the call package, and he was visibly just completely deflated when he realized that his call notes weren't being referenced by the president. And a lot of the interagency officials, I think, became very sad that the president didn't revere their policymaking apparatus.
Is it safe to say there's another reason the president's skeptical of relying on some of these individuals to carry out his foreign policy goals, like rooting out corruption in Ukraine?
I think the president is skeptical of the interagency bureaucracy.
Is that maybe why he instead relied on Secretary Perry, Ambassador Volker, Ambassador Sondland, and others?
Correct. And by the way, all three of those officials are not that far outside of the chain of the U.S. government.
Would it be appropriate in any investigation of corruption in Ukraine to exempt or remove, say, a political supporter?
Certainly would be.
Would it be inappropriate to remove a political opponent?
That's correct, yeah.
Would it be inappropriate to remove the son of a political opponent from any investigation involving Ukrainian corruption?
Absolutely. I mean, this all goes to the heart of bias.
Thank you for those answers. Mr. Chairman, I go back to what you said this morning about the facts being undisputed. I would argue that the facts, in fact, are disputed. And what you contend are facts are, in fact, not. They are witness presumptions, hearsay, and speculation. And the facts here are, in fact, that this is the shortest impeachment in U.S. history based on the thinnest of evidentiary records and on the narrowest grounds. Mr. Chairman, this impeachment process is a farce and a stain on the committee and on the House of Representatives, and I yield back.
The gentleman yields back. Ms. Garcia.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we just heard, the president and his supporters have claimed that the investigating committees are relying on hearsay and that they have failed to obtain firsthand accounts of the president's conduct. Now, I'm a former judge, and you, Mr. Goldman, a former prosecutor. We know what direct evidence is. Mr. Goldman, my Republican colleagues have suggested there is no direct evidence. Is that true?
No, there's a lot of direct evidence, and a lot of the evidence that they say is hearsay is actually not hearsay.
Indeed, it is not true. Now, I don't want to relive a law school evidence class. Instead, I'd like to go over some examples with you, and please tell me if they are direct or indirect evidence. Ambassador Sondland and Mr. Volker both testified that on May 23, 2019, President Trump told him to, quote, talk to Rudy about Ukraine. Is that direct evidence?
Yes, technically. Well, not technically, but yes.
Thank you. And then we have the memorandum of the July 25th call between President Trump and President Zelensky. Is that direct evidence?
Yes, that is.
So there is direct evidence that President Trump asked President Zelensky to look into these investigations and directed both President Zelensky and U.S. officials to talk to his personal attorney about those investigations, correct?
Yes, and if I could just jump in here on the July 25th call, because these four facts that we keep hearing about that are not in dispute, are three of them are completely wrong. So one of them happens to be that there's no quid pro quo mentioned in the July 25th call. There is absolutely a quid pro quo when President Zelensky says, I also wanted to thank you for your invitation to visit the United States, specifically Washington, D.C. And then he says, on the other hand, I also want to assure you that we will be very serious about the case and will work on the investigation. That is the quid pro quo that President Zelensky was informed of before the call. So that's wrong. It's also wrong that no Ukrainians knew about the aid being withheld at the time of the call, even though that doesn't even matter. But, and then finally, there was no White House meeting ever provided. So the third or fourth fact. So I do think that that just needs to be clarified, particularly as we're focusing on what direct evidence is.
Well, let's give some more examples. We also heard the testimony of three of the individuals who participated in the July 25 call. Is their testimony direct evidence of what happened during that call?
Yes, although I would say the call record is better evidence than their...
And the day after that call, David Holmes testified that on July 26, he overheard the president ask Ambassador Sondland whether President Zelensky was, quote, going to do the investigation. Is that direct evidence?
That is direct evidence.
And after the July 25 call record was released, the president got on the White House lawn and again declared that Ukraine should investigate a potential political opponent's family, the Bidens. Is that direct evidence?
Yes, it is.
His own words. Now, that seems to me like that's a lot of direct evidence. Mr. Goldman, was there other direct evidence that the committee relied on in addition to these?
Well, there's a lot of evidence that I would call direct evidence because it's not hearsay. If any of the people involved in the scheme are talking to each other, and they relay what someone else said, that is not hearsay. That would be in court a co-conspirator statement, and that would be admissible. So let's not get too far afield on talking about direct evidence.
We don't want to relive that law.
I understand, but it is very important because anything Mr. Giuliani says, anything Ambassador Sondland says, anything any of these people say is not hearsay and would be permitted under the Federal Rules of Evidence. Of course, we don't follow the Federal Rules of Evidence here, which is even more lenient, but that's an important point.
Right. Well, is there anything wrong, Mr. Goldman, with drawing inferences from circumstances?
Courts tell juries to draw inferences every single day in every single courtroom. That is how you determine what the evidence shows. So when Ambassador Sondland draws inferences from the fact that there is no explanation for the aid, the fact that the White House meeting has already been held up because of the investigations, and determines that that's the reason why the security assistance is also held up, that is a natural, logical inference that every jury draws across the country.
Well, I agree with you. I'm just disappointed that rather than to respond to the serious, factual, direct, and undisputed evidence before us, my colleagues continue to make unfounded arguments about the process. What President Trump did here was wrong. It's unconstitutional. And if anyone else did this, they would be held accountable. I urge all my colleagues to face this evidence and uphold the oaths each of us have taken to protect our Constitution. Our democracy depends on ensuring that no one, not even the President, is above the law. I yield back.
The gentlelady yields back. Mr. Neguse.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as we approach the ninth hour of this hearing, I want to thank both Mr. Goldman and Mr. Castor for being here today and for your testimony. There's been a lot of discussion about whether or not the facts in this matter are contested. I believe they are not contested. And so I'd like to level set here and give you both an opportunity to address some of the facts that I believe are not in dispute. And I want to begin by addressing something that I think we all know for certain, and that's that Russia interfered in our 2016 election. So, Mr. Goldman, after 2 years of investigation, the special counsel concluded that Russia interfered in our elections in, quote, sweeping and systemic fashion. Is that right?
Yes.
All right. Mr. Castor, is that right?
Yes.
And Mr. Goldman, am I correct that zero intelligence agencies have publicly stated that Ukraine attacked our elections in 2016? Is that right?
That's right. I don't even think that the minority is alleging that the Ukrainian government systematically in any meaningful way interfered. I think this is just based on a couple of news articles.
Mr. Castor, correct?
The president had a good faith belief there were some significant Ukrainian officials.
I hear you, and you said that previously. I guess I'm asking you.
We haven't said that the Ukrainian government.
And there are no intelligence agencies in the United States that have publicly stated that Ukraine has attacked our elections, right? You're not testifying that that's the case.
I'm not, right, correct.
And in fact, President Trump's former Homeland Security Advisor, Tom Bossert, said that the idea of Ukraine, for example, hacking the DNC server, was, quote, not only a conspiracy theory, it is completely debunked. That's President Trump's Homeland Security Advisor that said those words that you see on the screen to my right. Is that right, Mr. Goldman?
Yes, I saw that interview.
Mr. Castor, you saw that interview?
I'm aware of it, yes.
In fact, isn't it true that none of the witnesses that appeared before your committee testified in support of the theory that Ukraine somehow interfered in our elections? Is that right, Mr. Goldman?
That is absolutely correct.
Mr. Castor?
That's correct, but again,
thank you. No witnesses testified in support. I'll reclaim my time. No witnesses testified in support of that theory before your committee. Mr. Goldman, isn't it also true that your committee, in fact, received testimony indicating that there is evidence that Russia is, in part, perpetrating this false theory that Ukraine interfered in the 2016 elections because Russia wants to deflect blame for its own involvement?
That is correct. We had evidence of that, and I think that it's very important to emphasize what is evidence and what is pure media reports or speculation, because there is no evidence in our investigation that Ukraine interfered in the 2016 election.
And in fact, I'd like to put some of the testimony that I believe you might be referencing, Mr. Goldman, on the screen in front of you, both from Mr. Holmes as well as Dr. Fiona Hill. And I will quote from her testimony. I am very confident, based on all the analysis that has been done, and again, I don't want to start getting into intelligence matters, that the Ukraine government did not interfere in our election in 2016. This is a fictional narrative that is being perpetrated and propagated by the Russian security services themselves. You recall that testimony, Mr. Goldman?
I do. I also recall her testifying that in addition to the Ukrainian officials who made a couple of disparaging comments about President Trump, there are officials from countries all around the world who also made disparaging comments about President Trump. And as Dr. Hill said, their military assistance was not put on hold.
So given your testimony and given yours as well, Mr. Castor, it strikes me that there are, in fact, four uncontested facts. First, Russia attacked our 2016 elections. Several intelligence agencies have independently confirmed that this is true. Second, Ukraine did not attack our 2016 elections. There's absolutely no evidence that this baseless conspiracy theory. Third, there is evidence that Russia perpetrated the allegation that Ukraine interfered in our 2016 elections. And finally, that Russia benefits from the U.S. investigating Ukraine, which was made clear through public testimony before your committee. So, Mr. Goldman, is it fair to say that the intelligence community agrees with these four conclusions?
The intelligence community definitely agrees with one and two. Dr. Hill testified to three, as well as there's a public statement from Mr. Putin. And yes, certainly the witnesses emphasized four, that Russia benefits from this. And we saw in my opening statement, President Putin's comment that it's good now that Ukraine is all the talk.
And if that is the case, it begs the question, why would President Trump perpetuate this conspiracy theory already disproven by the entirety of the intelligence community that actually helps our adversary, a country that is attacking our elections in real time? With that, I yield.
The gentleman yields back. Mr. Stube.
Mr. Chairman, brief parliamentary inquiry about schedule.
The gentleman, Mr. Stube, has already been recognized. He has the time.
So are you going to recognize him after for his parliamentary inquiry after my question?
I'll make an announcement about schedule shortly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've never seen a more partisan spectacle than what I've witnessed here today. Democrats want the rules to apply when it benefits them and not to apply when Republicans invoke them. 9 hours ago now, Mr. Burke, a hired gun for the Democrats, got 30 minutes to spread his partisan rhetoric and then 45 minutes to cross-examine witnesses. That's 70 minutes more than most of the members of this committee who have been elected by their districts to serve in the United States Congress. And Mr. Burke is an unelected New York lawyer specifically brought in by the Democrats to give his opinion. A politically biased consultant who has given hundreds of thousands of dollars in federal elections to the likes of ActBlue, Hillary Clinton, Obama, and Biden. Mr. Burke gave over $5,000 alone to Hillary Clinton for her presidential race. No wonder why he has an axe to grind. Mr. Burke is a white-collar criminal defense lawyer who brags on his website of getting New York financial brokers deferred prosecution for tax fraud and fund managers off for insider trading charges. And Mr. Burke was able to say whatever he wanted to say without swearing an oath to his testimony that it would be truthful. So he can sit before this committee, not as a fact witness, and directly lie to the American people without any threat of criminal prosecution. Makes sense. He's a white-collar criminal defense lawyer. I'm sure he didn't want to incriminate himself. This is the same Mr. Burke who authored a series of reports as early as October 2017, 2 years ago, on his opinion as to whether President Trump obstructed justice and colluded with Russia. He also represented Mayor Bill de Blasio in a federal investigation of de Blasio's fundraising activities. For my fellow Americans and Floridians watching this charade, this is who was sitting at the top of the dais next to the chairman acting like a member of this committee, a partisan New York lawyer with written bias against President Trump who gave thousands to Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. And all of this spectacle, all of it, not a single fact witness has appeared in front of this committee. We have been denied a minority hearing day, which I asked for the last hearing. All we have had testify are partisan lawyers giving their opinions. So let's talk about the facts that we do have before us. We heard from Mueller. No evidence that the Trump campaign colluded or conspired with Russia to influence the 2016 election. No obstruction of justice. After denying the president to call witnesses in closed-door secret proceedings and denying Republicans from calling all their witnesses in closed-door proceedings, denying the president's counsel to cross-examine witnesses in intel hearings, the facts are this. Sondland stated when questioned, did the president tell you about any preconditions for anything? His answer, no. For the aid to be refused? No. For a White House meeting? No. Ambassador Sondland also testified that President Trump wanted nothing from Ukraine. Tim Morrison, when questioned, and there was no quid pro quo, answered, correct. The aid was released. Four facts never changed. Both President Trump and President Zelensky say there was no pressure. The call transcript shows no conditionality between aid and an investigation. No quid pro quo. Ukrainians were not aware that aid was withheld when the president spoke. Ukraine didn't open an investigation, but still received aid in a meeting with President Trump. Mr. Castro. Has any committee heard from the whistleblower, either in closed-door hearings or in open hearings?
No.
Did Chairman Schiff state that he would call the whistleblower to testify?
He did.
Has that happened?
It has not.
Is it going to occur?
I hope so.
Have other countries' aid also been held up?
Yes.
Mr. Goldman, on October 2nd, the New York Times reported that the whistleblower, quote, approached a House Intelligence Committee aide with his concerns about Mr. Trump. Is that accurate?
Sorry, say that again.
On October 2nd, the New York Times reported that the whistleblower approached a House Intelligence Committee aide with his concern about Mr. Trump. Is that accurate?
I think the whistleblower's concerns about President Trump are from the threats that
No, that's not what I'm asking. I'm asking, did the whistleblower approach a House Intelligence Committee? Let me ask it a different way. Have you had any communications with the whistleblower?
As I said earlier in response to questions from your colleagues, I'm not going to get into any...
So you're refusing to answer whether you've communicated with the whistleblower?
The whistleblower is not relevant to this report.
He's the whole basis of the beginning of this investigation. He's absolutely relevant to this committee
and to the
American people.
The whistleblower's complaints, for the reasons that Mr. Castor said, are not included. His allegations are not included in our report because the evidence has been outstripped and surpassed by the 17 witnesses that we have had come in to testify directly about the conduct that the whistleblower
So as you sit here today, do you know the identity of the whistleblower?
Sir, I'm not going to talk to you about the identity of the whistleblower.
Because you're also refusing to answer whether you've had communications. That's my time, not yours. You're refusing to answer whether you had communications with the whistleblower. Has any other staff in the Intel Committee had communications with the whistleblower?
Sir, in the intelligence
committee, you're refusing to answer that question. And unfortunately, the American people want to know those answers, and unfortunately, my time
is expired. Congress has a right to maintain the anonymity.
Mr. Chairman, point of order, Mr. Chairman.
Time.
Mr. Chairman, I have unanimous consent.
The gentleman will suspend. The time of the gentleman has expired.
Mr. Chairman, I have a unanimous consent.
The gentleman will state his unanimous consent request.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I ask for admission of the document entitled Ukrainian Efforts to Sabotage Trump Backfire, dated January 11, 2017.
It's a political article.
If you give it to our staff, we'll take a look at it and we'll make it.
Should I make a motion to insert instead, Mr. Chairman?
Part of their intern crew is political.
Before I recognize Ms. McBath, I want to announce that with respect to scheduling, this hearing will proceed until the votes are called. It may end before votes are called, which would be nice. If it does not end before votes are called, then we will recess for the votes and we'll reconvene here as soon as the votes on the floor are over. It's going to be a close call. We'll see. I will further announce that I'm not prepared to say anything further about the schedule of the committee beyond today's hearing.
Point of order,
Who seeks recognition for a point of order?
I do, Mr. Chairman.
Who's I?
To your right, Mr. Chairman.
It's only yours.
For what purpose does Mr. Doyle seek recognition?
To ask, I wanted to confirm, a point of order is there are rules of decorum, and I don't believe that the gentleman from Florida meant to violate them, and I want to give him the benefit of the doubt, but more than once he referred to a New York lawyer, and if he could just explain what he meant, then I'm prepared to withdraw my point of order.
It's not a point of order. That's not a cognizable point of order.
Mr. Chairman, point of order regarding the schedule.
There's no point of order regarding
the schedule. Well, on this case there is, because
there's no point of order regarding the schedule.
Will you answer my question?
The gentleman will suspend. There is no cognizable point of order regarding the future schedule.
Okay. Parliamentary inquiry. Will you recognize that?
No. Ms. McBath is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Goldman, I want to follow up on just one part of President Trump's conduct that, I asked our constitutional scholars about last week. The investigative committees found evidence that President Trump intimidated, threatened, and tampered with prospective and actual witnesses in the impeachment inquiry, correct?
Yes.
And, Mr. Goldman, it is a federal crime to intimidate or to seek to intimidate any witness appearing before Congress. Is that right?
Yes, there's a little bit more to it, but that's the gist of it, yes.
Mr. Goldman, am I correct that President Trump publicly attacked witnesses before, after, and even during their testimony?
That is correct.
I'd like to quickly go through some examples. On Twitter, the president tried to smear Ambassador Bill Taylor, a former military officer who graduated at the top of his class at West Point, served as an infantry commander in Vietnam, and earned a Bronze Star and an air medal with a V device for valor. He was attacked for doing his duty to tell the truth to the American people, correct?
He did his duty by testifying, yes.
President Trump also attacked other Trump administration officials who testified before the Intelligence Committee, including Lieutenant Colonel Alexander S. Vindman, who is the director for Ukraine on the National Security Council, and Jennifer Williams, the special advisor on Europe and Russia with the office of the vice president. Am I right?
That is right, yes.
Mr. Goldman, I think another troubling example of this is the president's treatment of Ambassador Yovanovitch. When you question Ambassador Yovanovitch, you asked her about the president's remark that she would, and I quote, go through some things. She told you that remark sounded like a threat. Is that right?
Yes, in the July 25th call, that's when President Trump said that.
Ambassador Yovanovitch is a career professional who served in Republican and Democratic administrations. She was once caught in live crossfire during a coup attempt. And here's how she described that experience in her very own words.
I later served in Moscow. In 1993, during the attempted coup in Russia, I was caught in crossfire between presidential and parliamentary forces. It took us three tries, me without a helmet or body armor, to get into a vehicle to go to the embassy. We went because the ambassador asked us to come. And we went because it was our duty.
It was our duty. Even under such duress, this is a public servant who did her duty. And as she testified before you and the Intelligence Committee, the president tweeted yet another attack against her. Is that correct?
During the testimony, yes.
At a rally, the president further attacked Ambassador Taylor and Deputy Assistant Secretary of the State, George Kent, Foreign Affairs Commission official with decades of bipartisan service. I just have to say, I am so deeply saddened that our president has attacked our brave public servants. These attacks are an abuse of his power, and they betray our national interest. My Republican colleagues until now have agreed with me that this behavior is not okay. That in America we protect witnesses and people who tell the truth. We want people to come forward. We protect witnesses in our community. I myself am no stranger to these kinds of attacks. They are not okay. I want to read a partial statement by Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, who is a military officer and a public servant. In his opening statement to the Intelligence Committee, Mr. Vindman said, and I quote, "I want to say that the character attacks on these distinguished and honorable public servants is reprehensible. I ran for Congress because I care urgently about health care, gun violence prevention, and our veterans. Those are the urgent policies for me and many of my colleagues. But these witnesses, these public servants, stood up and courageously told the truth. And I must be courageous and stand up for them as well. And I yield back the balance of my time."
The gentlelady yields back the balance of her time. A few minutes ago, Mr. Biggs asked unanimous consent to admit an article from Politico into the record. Without objection, Mr. Stanton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've heard today from some suggesting that this process has somehow been unfair. Mr. Goldman, let's clear up that record. Minority members on the investigative committees had access to all witness depositions. Is that correct?
Yes, and all the documents.
And were they allowed to ask questions of every witness?
The minority was given equal time to the majority for every single interview, deposition, or hearing that we did.
And the minority were allowed to call their own witnesses to the live hearings, is that correct?
They were also, yes, and they got three witnesses. They were also allowed to call their own witnesses for the depositions. They chose not to do that. The only witness they requested for the deposition was Chairman Schiff, who is not a fact witness to this investigation.
Mr. Goldman, why did the investigative committees decide to conduct initial depositions behind closed doors?
The best investigative practice when you're doing a fact-finding mission is to keep the information closed. And the reason is exactly what I described earlier with Ambassador Sondland, who, first of all, the day before his deposition, he spoke with Secretary Perry about his testimony. That is the type of tailoring that can happen when people are engaged in misconduct and they try to line up their stories. So if you keep the information closed, they can't line up their stories. And I think, frankly, part of the reason why Ambassador Volker and Ambassador Sondland's public hearing testimony was so different from their deposition testimony is because the initial depositions were in closed session before we then released all the transcripts to the public.
And this isn't unprecedented because In both the Nixon and Clinton impeachment inquiries, there were either closed-door depositions or grand jury proceedings at the beginning of the inquiries.
That's correct, nor is it unprecedented in Congress. This is actually a rule in the House rules that was passed by Republican Congresses. It was used in Benghazi. It was used by a number of committees for the past decade or so.
And for clarity, President Trump has received all procedural protections afforded to other presidents facing impeachment. Is that correct?
That is right. In the Judiciary Committee, he's had all of the options. Our inquiry was not the Judiciary Committee's investigation. That is where the president's ability to present evidence. Of course, if the president wanted to present evidence in the Intelligence Committee, he could have provided documents, he could have provided the witnesses that we asked for him, but he obstructed rather than cooperated.
And the president has been invited to participate in the House's impeachment inquiry, correct?
Yes.
And the president declined the invitation?
That's my understanding, yes.
Twice?
Twice thus far, yes.
In fact, the president not only refused to participate, but he has also tried to stop Congress from obtaining evidence. Isn't it true that the president has refused to produce any documents in response to the impeachment inquiry's subpoena to the White House?
Yes.
Not a single one?
Not a single document.
The president also directed all of his agencies to refuse to produce documents. Is that right?
That is also true.
Based on the president's order, federal agencies have ignored more than 70 specific requests or demands for records from the investigative committees. Is that correct?
Yes, and if I could just add, this would ordinarily be a document case. If you were prosecuting this case, you'd be basing it on the documents. So the fact that those documents are being withheld is quite significant, and it's quite remarkable that we built the record we have on the witnesses.
The president's order to obstruct Congress didn't just extend to documents. At the president's direction, witnesses also refused to testify. Is that right?
That's correct.
And in total, more than a dozen members of the administration defied lawful subpoenas or requests for testimony or documents, as we see on the slide.
Right. Between testimony and documents, that's correct.
And isn't it also true that when witnesses chose to follow the laws and testify, the president denied those witnesses access to the documents they needed to properly prepare for their testimony?
For some of them, that's correct.
But I also must acknowledge that this process has been challenging and in many respects less than fair. I have not had access to all of my phone records, State Department emails, and many, many other State Department documents. And I was told I could not work with my EU staff to pull together the relevant files and information. These documents are not classified, and in fairness, should have been made available.
The State Department has collected all materials in response to the September 27th subpoena that may contain facts relevant to my testimony. I have no such documents or materials with me today.
The president was not denied the right to participate, quite the opposite. The president has chosen not to participate, and he has consistently tried to obstruct the impeachment investigation to ensure no one testifies against him, that no one produces a document that may incriminate him, and to engage in a cover-up to prevent the American people from learning the truth. I yield back.
Mr. Chairman, may I just say something for 5 seconds? Mr. Chairman, please.
Gentlemen, for what purpose is the gentleman seated?
No, this is the witness. Can I just say something for 5 seconds?
No. Ms. Dean is recognized.
Good job.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Goldman, some have argued that we should wait, that we're moving too fast, that we should try to get more evidence. Let's examine why these arguments are without merit. President Nixon stated during the Senate Watergate investigation, quote, all members of the White House staff will appear voluntarily when requested by the committee. They will testify under oath, and they will answer fully all proper questions, end quote. During the investigation of President Clinton, Ken Starr interviewed White House staff. President Clinton also provided written responses to 81 interrogatories from the House Judiciary Committee. Unlike his predecessors, President Trump has categorically stonewalled Congress's investigation at every turn. Indeed, as far back as April, the president expressed his intent to stonewall.
Well, we're fighting all the subpoenas.
More recently, on October the 8th, White House counsel Pat Cipollone echoed this sentiment. in a letter reflecting the president's instruction that all executive branch officials not testify in this impeachment inquiry. Are you aware of that letter, Mr. Goldman?
Yes, I am.
And Mr. Goldman, is it fair to say that President Trump is the only president in the history of our country to seek to completely obstruct an impeachment inquiry undertaken by this House?
That is correct. It is unprecedented.
And in fact, pursuant to President Trump's order, 12 executive branch officials refused to testify as part of the House impeachment inquiry, 10 of whom defied congressional subpoenas. Am I right?
Yes.
Given the president's sweeping directive not to cooperate with Congress, did the investigative committees believe that there was any chance that other administration officials would come forward if subpoenaed?
No, it became clear that the president was trying to block everything and block everyone, and eventually they came up with an alternative reason to write an opinion to prevent people from coming, which is quite an aggressive view that they took. But it was quite clear that they were trying to block every single witness.
Some have said that the investigative committee should have gone to court. Did you decide not to go to court?
We thought about it a lot because obviously there are additional witnesses and we want this to be as thorough an investigation. But as you can see from the Deutsche Bank case or the McGahn case, it takes months and months to go through the appeals court. And that's effectively what the president wants, is just to delay this as long as possible until the next election.
Let's take a look at that exact case, the McGahn case, because we're all intimately aware of it. On April 22nd, this Judiciary Committee served a subpoena for testimony to White House counsel Don McGahn. And after McGahn refused to testify on May 21st, the committee filed a lawsuit on August the 7th to compel his testimony. And even though we did request expedited ruling, it was another 3.5 months before Judge Jackson found the Constitution does not allow a president to kneecap congressional investigations because, as the judge wrote, and I put up on this screen, quote, presidents are not kings. As you know, McGahn has appealed, and a hearing is set for January the 3rd now of next year. As we sit here today, 8 months since we issued that subpoena, would you agree it's likely we will not have an appeals court ruling for many months to come?
It's quite possible that it could be several more months, and then there may be the Supreme Court.
Exactly. McGahn may appeal to the Supreme Court, and conceivably that could take another many months, year, more.
Depends on whether it's this term or it gets pushed over to the next term. But yes.
And given this delay, illustrated by the McGahn example specifically, would you agree that if we go to court to enforce the investigative committee subpoenas, we could face another months or years long delay to hear testimony?
Absolutely. And there's an ongoing threat, because the president is trying to cheat to win the next election. It's not something that happened in the past. It's continuing in the future. So we cannot delay and just wait for the courts to resolve this, when the reason why we would have to go to the courts is because the president is obstructing an investigation into himself.
And the urgency is not just about our elections, but also our national security. Am I right?
That is a critical component to it.
Let me end with this. What is plain is that we cannot wait. What is plain is that wait means never. We must not let this president disregard, defy, and delay justice. This president has shown that he repeatedly abuses the power entrusted to him by the people. Every moment we wait is another opportunity to chip away at the foundation of our Constitution, so carefully crafted by our founders. I thank you, Mr. Chairman, and yield back.
Gentlelady yields back. I yield to Ms. Jackson-Lee for the unanimous consent request.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Goldman, Mr. Castor. I'd like to submit or ask unanimous consent to insert in the record, referred in my questioning, statement of administration policy, Department of Defense appropriation.
Without objection.
August 5th.
Without objection, Mr. McCarcel.
And the call dated July 25th.
Without objection, Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Castor, it's been a long day. It's been a long couple months. You've been in the middle of this, and I know previously you wanted to say something, so.
Thank you. I've resisted my willingness to be athletic here in the afternoon.
but I want to say a few things. First of all, the Republicans on the Intelligence Committee submitted a number of subpoenas, and we never got a vote. There was a motion to table. It disposed of them. Ranking Member Nunes sent a letter on November 8th asking for witnesses. Ranking Member Collins sent a letter on December 6th asking for witnesses. Some of these witnesses would have touched at the heart of the issue that our members are concerned about, and that is, were Ukrainians trying to interfere with our elections? I mean, this is a fact that is meritorious of investigation. The Ukrainians ought to investigate it, and to the extent it happened here in the U.S., we ought to be investigating it. And so to the extent... that hasn't happened. Republicans have attempted to do that during this process. So I'd like to say that. And I have a couple other things, Mr. Armstrong, if
go
I
ahead.
May. Ambassador Sondland is relied on, and he went from a witness that was not very favorable to very favorable at his hearing. And one of the remarkable statements at his hearing was that everyone was in the loop. And he types up this email to Pompeo, to the secretary. And the emails that he used to demonstrate that everyone was in the loop are not conclusive at all. He talks about this statement that was going back and forth during the early part of August. First of all, Volker said all along that he didn't think the statement was a good idea. Volker and Yermak toyed around with the statement, and ultimately both sides decided that it wasn't a good plan. So they didn't do it. And so the fact that Sondland is emailing the secretary talking about this statement and so forth, this doesn't show that everyone's in the loop. Ambassador Hale testified to us that people at the State Department, they don't just email the secretary. I mean, the secretary gets email, of course, but it's not like this. There's a whole secretariat that filters his email. And so it's not emailing the Secretary of State is not quite as simple as I think Ambassador Sondland made it seem here. And so I just wanted to address that. We talked a couple times about the reliability of George Kent's notes. One of Ambassador Volker's assistants, Catherine Croft, testified, and it was a rather startling piece of testimony. She was asked whether Kent's notes would be reliable. Sort of a typical question, everyone expecting the answer to be yes, except she said no. I don't think Kent's notes would be reliable. So I think that's important to put on the record that, that there is evidence that, perhaps Mr. Kent, felt some emotions about some of these issues, and his notes, at least according to one State Department official, might not, in fact, be reliable. The CNN interview that there's been discussion about. Okay, there was discussion about possibly doing a statement which was canned. There was, maybe there was discussion of a CNN interview, but
that's fine.
We did not really get to the bottom of that. That was sort of this amorphous fact that was out there. Ambassador Taylor testified that he was worried it would happen, but we didn't really talk to anyone that could tell us precisely what was going to occur, in the CNN interview, and whether President Zelensky was actually going to do it. If you look back at the statement that Yermak and Volker were talking about, Yermak wasn't comfortable doing it. And so when it comes to the CNN interview, it's possible that Yermak would have advised President Zelensky not to say what people thought he was going to say. So anyway, I'm sorry, Mr. Armstrong, for taking
No, time. You've worked hard and you deserve it. I just want to end and summarize with this, that you can, because you cannot prove a crime, and Chairman went on TV yesterday and said they get a conviction in 3 minutes, but my question is, for what crime? The Mueller conspiracy fell flat. The obstruction charge was abandoned when the public hearing was over. Campaign finance is a non-starter. The victim of conspiracy, or the victim of bribery and extortion, says he's not a victim. Because you can't prove any of it does not mean you can use all of it. And that's no way to prosecute a case, and it is no way to proceed with impeachment. Thank you.
The gentleman yields back.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. McCarthy-Powell.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. McCarthy-Powell is recognized.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. McCarthy-Powell is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Goldman, I want to come back and highlight what I think is the biggest national security threat, and that's foreign interference into our elections. And I can tell you that in Florida, we're extremely concerned about the security of our elections and the potential for election interference by foreign governments, especially Russia, because Florida, my home state, was a victim of Russian hacking in 2016. And there's every indication that they're trying to do the same thing right now. Our country was founded on the premise that our elected officials are elected by the people. But President Trump doesn't share these ideas. He has and continues to demand foreign interference into our elections. He doesn't want the American people to decide. He's inviting foreign interference, allowing foreign governments to decide that for us. Mr. Goldman, it's been confirmed that President Trump's campaign actively sought Russia's interference in our 2016 elections, correct?
What Special Counsel Mueller said is that President Trump did invite them and solicit them to hack Hillary Clinton's emails. Ultimately, the Trump campaign, I think it was welcomed, knew about the interference, welcomed it, and utilized it.
Right. And in 2016, Trump said, Russia, if you're listening, and within 5 hours, Russian intelligence targeted the emails of Trump's opponent. On October 3rd, 2019, when asked what he hoped President Zelensky would do about the Bidens, this is what President Trump said.
Well, I would think that if they were honest about it, they'd start a major investigation into the Bidens. It's a very simple answer. They should investigate the Bidens, because how does a company that's newly formed, and all these companies, if you look at, and by the way, likewise, China should start an investigation into the Bidens.
And let me just point out, the president doesn't mention corruption, does he, Mr. Goldman?
No, he doesn't. As I said, it became quite clear in all of his comments and all of the other witnesses that any mention of corruption or anti-corruption was really meant, and the evidence showed this, was really a euphemism for the investigations.
Correct. And Trump is not only asking, President Trump, excuse me, is not only asking Ukraine, but he also says China should start investigating his political opponents. The president's pattern of behavior is incredibly disturbing. Russia, Ukraine, China, he's inviting three countries to help him in his reelection campaign. And Mr. Goldman, I don't see any reason to believe he wouldn't ask any other governments, for example, Venezuela, correct?
He could, I mean, at this point, he has shown not only a willingness to do it multiple times, but I think more importantly for all of the members' consideration, he's also shown a lack of contrition, a lack of acknowledgement that what he is doing is wrong and that it is wrong. And if you don't recognize that it is wrong, then there is no reason why you won't do it again if you've already done it.
Exactly. I mean, we saw Giuliani in Ukraine just 3 days ago. And last night, I want to point out that the Washington Post actually released an article saying that Rudy Giuliani has been now advising on how to open a back channel between President Trump and Maduro. So I'm very worried about that. Now, I don't think we have any time to wait to see if any countries are now going to take him up on the offer to help him in his reelection campaign. Mr. Goldman, did the investigative committees reach any conclusions about the ongoing threats, the continuing risk that the president poses?
Yes, for the same reasons that we just discussed. I mean, and I think the June of television interview with George Stephanopoulos this year, where the president indicated that he would once again welcome foreign interference, is another data point to understand where it is. And I would just say to Mr. Reschenthaler, who was saying that he's got such a great record and that the Democrats just don't want him to win, the question is, if that is the case, and that very well may be the case, then why does he need to cheat to win the election? Why can't he just go on his own platform?
I think the Constitution demands that the president follow the rule of law and fight to keep our elections fair, free of corruption, and free of foreign interference.
Now, I know that I was elected by the people of Florida, and I work only for the people of this country. I'm not going to let, while I'm in office, anyone interfere in our elections or threaten our democracy. The continuing pattern of behavior we've seen from this president should be a warning to the American people that it is a beginning of a dictatorship, which I have seen in Latin America. I've witnessed men in office abuse the power, inviting foreign interference, and also obstructing any checks on their power. The Constitution has no partisan allegiance. We cannot allow this behavior from this president or any future president. Our democracy depends on it.
The gentlelady yields back. I recognize Mr. Jordan for the purpose of a unanimous consent request.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
I recognize Mr. Jordan for the purpose of a unanimous consent request.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The majority's witness was wrong when he said that we were able to subpoena people and get our witnesses here.
Unanimous consent request.
We were not. So I ask unanimous consent to enter into the record the two letters sent to Chairman Nadler and the other one to...
Without objection, the material will be entered into the record. Ms. Escobar is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and many thanks to our witnesses who've spent the entire day with us. We're very grateful. Despite what our Republican colleagues have stated over and over again, their own witness, Mr. Castor, has agreed that these investigations have indeed produced direct evidence. Direct evidence which any objective observer, in my opinion, would regard as overwhelming. That evidence proves that the president solicited foreign interference in the 2020 election, pressured Ukrainian President Zelensky to publicly announce unfounded investigations, conditioned a White House meeting, the president conditioned a White House meeting and $391 million on the announcement of the investigations, and then the president covered up his conduct and obstructed the investigation. Those findings reflect a serious abuse of power by the president. Yet we are being asked to ignore what we've seen with our own eyes and what we've heard with our own ears. So, Mr. Goldman, I'd like your help in responding to some of the claims that my Republican colleagues have made today.
Happily.
The president and his allies say that there was no quid pro quo. In other words, they claim that the president wasn't withholding the aid in exchange for the manufactured political investigation. Isn't it true that the aid was withheld and that there has been no logical explanation for the withholding of that aid?
There's common sense that leads one to conclude that the aid was withheld for the investigations. And then there's also direct evidence in that the president's own words to Ambassador Sondland on September 7th said the same thing.
Thank you. President Trump knew he had leverage over President Zelensky. And in fact, David Holmes testified that Ambassador Sondland told President Trump that President Zelensky will, quote, do anything you ask him. Is that correct?
That is what Ambassador Sondland said. Yeah, or actually, that's what Ambassador Sondland said to President Trump. Apologies.
You testified earlier that evidence shows that the Ukrainians, in fact, did know that the aid was being withheld. My colleagues continue to say, and their witness continue to say, that there couldn't be leverage because they had no idea that the aid was being withheld. Yet there has been evidence that shows that they knew. Is that correct?
Well, I think it's important just for a second here to take a step back. It doesn't matter when they knew, as long as they knew at some point. Then they realized at that point that the investigations were dependent on the aid. But there, in addition, there is a lot of evidence that they knew before it became public on August 28th.
And you're right. It doesn't matter. If you're about to be held up at gunpoint by a burglar, it doesn't matter whether you know or not. The intent is still there by the criminal about to commit the act. My Republican colleagues also make much about the fact that the aid was finally released. But isn't it true that it wasn't released until the president got caught?
It wasn't released until the president got caught, and all of the money didn't actually get to Ukraine in that fiscal year, and you all in Congress had to pass another law to allow for the money to get to Ukraine.
Thank you. Earlier today, Mr. Castor attempted to explain away the president's request for foreign interference in our election by claiming that the president had three concerns. That number one, the president was concerned about Ukraine corruption. That number two, he was concerned about burden sharing with Europe. And number three, he brought up the debunked conspiracy theory about Ukraine election interference, which, by the way, that last point we know is a Russian talking point. Mr. Goldman, did the investigative committees consider those three explanations? And if so, what did the evidence show about whether President Trump's request was actually motivated by those concerns?
It's a very good question. There are two things that were discussed here today. One is evidence, and one is assertions and opinions. Based on the evidence, there is no evidence to support any of those three things that you just mentioned. There's no evidence to think that the president acted towards Ukraine because of his concerns about corruption, even if he held those concerns. That was not the motivating factor. There's no evidence that his concern about other European countries giving enough money motivated him. And there is certainly not a reasonable belief, given all of the evidence, that he believed that Ukraine interfered in our 2016 elections.
Thank you. I'd like to close with what our scholars explained to us last week about why all of this is so important.
Drawing a foreign government into our elections is an especially serious abuse of power because it undermines democracy itself.
Because if we cannot impeach a president who abuses his office for personal advantage, we no longer live in a democracy. We live in a monarchy, or we live under a dictatorship.
If what we're talking about is not impeachable, then nothing is impeachable.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I yield back.
Gentlelady yields back.
Can I respond to that?
This concludes the five-minute round of questioning. I now recognize Mr. Raskin for the purpose of a unanimous consent request.
Mr. Chairman, I'm seeking unanimous consent to introduce a statement by the late Chairman Elijah Cummings of the Oversight Committee in his first hearing in the new Congress, which was on examining prescription drug prices. His first hearing was not about Michael Cohen, as was asserted earlier.
Without objection, I now recognize the ranking member for any concluding remarks he may have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One quick thing before we enter. It does matter when they knew and didn't know, because after they supposedly found out, it does matter because after they had two meetings with officials from the United States, it was never talked about and no linkage was made. So it does matter. And the reason it matters is because if there is no understanding that this is being withheld, there is no threat, there is no quid pro quo. And it also goes to the state of mind of Mr. Zelensky, who says, I'm not being pressured. There's nothing here. And again, it goes back to the amazing thought of this majority who keeps calling the Ukrainian leader a liar. It's just amazing that we continue to propagate that myth here tonight. But what did we learn today? Here's some things we did learn today. This unprecedented hearing that Mr. Sensenbrenner and others talked about, in which staff basically, not members, gave testimony and questioned each other and got into very heated debates with each other. This is not what the Judiciary Committee should be doing. It's not the way this should be held. Again, the reason it is, Mr. Goldman handled himself very well, but he's not Adam Schiff. He doesn't wear a member pin. This is ridiculous. We shouldn't be doing this. The Intel Committee also, what we did find out today, took phone records and went on a political endeavor against the ranking member and others, but no one will take responsibility for telling the staff to use Mr. Nunez's numbers or others, or who decided to put the smear job in the report. We'll just assume that's Mr. Schiff, since I do hold the member accountable. You know, also we found out today, which is really interesting, that staff can determine what's relevant or not, not members of Congress. It's interesting to me that staff told members of Congress that that wasn't relative or that wasn't relevant. Again, it goes back to the problem that we don't have members here to actually talk about this. Also, it just is another thing we've learned today, that the chairman continues to just disregard House rules. Just completely, blatantly disregarding House rules on not addressing the minority hearing today. And if I hear, basically, one more time, I'll address that when we're marking up impeachment articles. What is the use of a minority hearing day if you're going to have evidence about the markup if you get the confirmation at the markup itself? Even your most heated debate on getting rid of this president does not show any way that can be fair. And in the end, both parties are in the minority. If you destroy the institutional integrity, which again, the staff have talked about today, if we destroy the institutional integrity, there's nothing else for us to do. But while we were here, there was something that did happen. And as we were sitting here discussing whether to impeach the president over a call he had with the Ukrainian president and President Zelensky, which took place on how there was a look at how it happened in 2016. Democrats are seeking to impeach the president over that, and we're seeing the problems with the Russia investigation play out again in front of our eyes. The fuss over the Ukraine is the same thing, using the same playbook. A select group of individuals colluding against the President Trump to ensure they get him, and they are blowing through every procedure and principle of fairness and honesty to ensure they get him in time. So what happened today? While we were stuck here, the Inspector General report. The review of 4FISA applications and other aspects of the FBI Crossfire Hurricane investigation. Here's some of the top findings. The FBI included inaccurate information in the Carter Page FISA application. The FBI failed to include exculpatory information in the FISA. The FBI did not corroborate a huge amount of the information in the Page FISA. The FBI chose to defensively brief candidate Clinton, not candidate Trump. The FBI failed to disclose Bruce Orr's information that Steele reporting was going directly to the Clinton campaign. An FBI attorney altered another agency's email to mislead about whether Carter Page had actually been a UTL's intelligent source. The bottom line, the report shows the Page FISA should have never been obtained. If you don't have the Page FISA, you don't have a Russia investigation. If you don't have a Russia investigation, you can't knock out the president as a candidate at the time of the 26th election, and you can't hamstring the president's first 2 years with a special counsel investigation. I could go on, but Mr. Durham, who has already weighed in, has the next batch of this, and we'll see where it goes. But I do want to take one last thing from our side, because this undoubtedly will be the last hearing, because we have no desire to hear anything from our side, minority hearing or otherwise. I want to take time to thank Mr. Castor and Ms. Callum. They're the top investigators in the Intelligence and Judiciary Committee, and they combined have 15 to 20 years experience in the House conducting investigations to protect American interests and taxpayer dollars. What these public servants don't usually do as a part of their work is field questions from others who come before them, from Democrats, donors, and pundits. Ms. Castor and Ms. Callum usually work for and alongside members of Congress and fellow public servants. I'm sorry today that the majority chose to highlight their investigators and also the ones that have been brought in over these public servants. I'm sorry to choose that this is where we're at, but I would like to thank them for their work today. I'd like to thank them for their work on our behalf, but also I think really for all the ones listening here, if you look around the room, this is what's happening to the American people. By the end of the day, most in the back left, most of the members of the media are begging to go somewhere else, because at the end of the day, your case isn't made. And one thing that just keeps amazingly said, from Mr. Goldman to the chairman to others, these facts are undisputed. The very nature of the fact that I say I disagree and you say you don't is a disputed fact. These are disputed facts. It'll be the first impeachment that is partisan on facts that are not agreed to. That is the state in which the judiciary has become. We have become a rubber stamp, just as the chairman predicted almost 20 years ago, when we willingly accept from someone else a project or a report that we don't investigate ourselves. And with that, that is the problem we have, and that is the farce called the Judiciary Committee impeachment scam today. I yield back.
I now recognize myself for concluding remarks. After hearing the reports and the evidence today, we now know several things with certainty. We know that the president was at the center of a scheme to pressure Ukraine to announce an investigation of the president's political rivals. He applied that pressure by withholding both a White House meeting and vital military aid. He made that demand directly to President Zelensky and confirmed his personal involvement on the White House lawn. We know that there are no excuses for this conduct. It is no excuse that President Trump eventually released the aid after his scheme was revealed to the public. And it is no excuse that he insisted that there was no quid pro quo only after his scheme was revealed to the public. We know that his actions endangered our national security, putting our alliances, our reputation, and our safety at risk. We know that the president also compromised the integrity of our elections for a corrupt, private, political purpose. We know that President Trump, in an unprecedented act of obstruction, ordered everybody in the executive branch to defy all congressional subpoenas for documents and subpoenas related to the impeachment inquiry. And we know that his attempts to solicit a political favor from the government of Ukraine fit a pattern of conduct that the president established in 2016 when he solicited political assistance from the government of Russia. That pattern of misconduct undermines our national security and undermines free and fair elections. In abusing his office in this manner and in obstructing the investigation that followed, We know that President Trump has put himself before his country. I am struck by the fact that my Republican colleagues have offered no serious scrutiny of the evidence at hand. They have talked about everything else, but they have offered not one substantive word in the president's defense. I suspect that is because there is at base no real defense for the president's actions. President Trump put himself before his country. There is a constitutional remedy for a president who undermines our national security and our elections, who puts his own interests before those of the country. That remedy is impeachment. The facts are clear. The danger to our democracy is clear. And our duty is clear. President Trump violated his oath to the American people. He placed his own private interests ahead of our national security and the integrity of our elections, and constitutes a continuing threat to the integrity of our elections and to our democratic system of government. Such conduct is clearly impeachable. This committee will proceed accordingly. This concludes today's hearing. We thank all of our presenters for participating. Without objection, all members will have 5 legislative days to submit additional written questions for the presenters or additional materials for the record. Without objection, the hearing is adjourned.